For KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio. All right, everybody, thanks for tuning into the show. It is Anti-War Radio here on Pacifica. New Year's Eve, 2009. Happy New Year to you. You might remember this article from a couple of weeks back from the Times of London. Secret document exposes Iran's nuclear trigger. This was taken by politicians and TV news people all over the world to mean that the CIA National Intelligence Estimate of 2007 was wrong. The Iranians have a secret nuclear weapons program and something must be done about it. However, if you look at Tuesday's front page at antiwar.com, you'll see the article, Giraldi, U.S. Intel found Iran nuke document was forged. The article's by Gareth Porter. The source is Philip Giraldi. He's a former CIA officer. He writes for the American Conservative magazine, antiwar.com, and the Campaign for Liberty. He's part of the American Conservative Defense Alliance and other things like that. And he's the guest on our show right now. Welcome, Phil. How are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for joining us today. So, boy, you sure do debunk forgeries a lot. Let's go back over what exactly the London Times claimed here and then what it was that you learned about their claims.
Well, in this case, the London Times had a story that Iran had been developing a what they refer to as a nuclear trigger. It's like the technology that's used to initiate a nuclear reaction. Obviously, it's something you need to have a bomb. The story was based on an alleged document dating to 2007, which would have a great deal of significance because in 2007, the Central Intelligence Agency came out with a national intelligence estimate that said that Iran had abandoned its nuclear weapons program in 2003. So the story is quite significant. And obviously, the document itself has attracted a bit of attention. And in this case, my sources were able to confirm what I had suspected, which was that the story and the document that it's based on are bogus.
Okay, now, what can you tell us about your sources?
Well, my sources are in the intelligence community. I don't want to say anything more than that, obviously, because if I were to be more specific, they wouldn't be my sources anymore. But the sources are very reliable, have good access to this kind of information. And the story itself, you know, kind of smelled right from the beginning because it was too cute. It was yet another story appearing in a Rupert Murdoch-owned publication that supported the case for war against Iran. And Rupert Murdoch Publications, and in particular, the Times of London has frequently served as conduits for stories that originate either with Israeli intelligence or British intelligence.
Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, even going back to, if I remember right, let's see, hijacker given anthrax flask by Iraqi agent. Saturday, October 27th, 2001, apparently Al-Qaeda did the anthrax attack, and they got the anthrax from Saddam Hussein, it says here, Phil.
Well, I guess that's another story we can look at while holding our noses. Journalists go out and they use their own sources to get information, to write up stories and stuff like that. You can't blame them for being aggressive in this effort. But the fact is that a lot of this information that the Times publishes comes from what I believe to be intelligence sources that are basically planting stories with a certain political objective in mind.
Mm-hmm. And now, help me out with my memory here. I thought it was a Times article, but I can't find it. The Iranians were developing a way to cut grooves into uranium spheres and then set the detonation equipment in there with some kind of det cord or some crap to set off an implosion thing. And I remember talking with Gordon Prather about it, and he just laughed and laughed till he almost lost his breath about how silly that was. That's not how you set off a bomb with, you know, the kind of cord you would use between a blasting cap and some explosives in a quarry or something like that. We're talking millisecond timing for nuclear implosion bombs.
Yeah, well, I don't remember that specific story, but if you recall that it's coming from a British source, it probably was the Times. And the fact is that, you know, they have a lot of these stories, and a lot of them, you know, they're there and then they're gone the next day because everybody else kind of realizes that they're phony. But the problem is that this kind of this creates kind of a narrative, you know, where you have a bunch of stories appearing saying basically that Iran is wildly pursuing a nuclear weapon. It has an impact on the public. It has an impact in terms of people down the road putting all these stories together and saying, yeah, of course, there's no dispute about it. It appeared in the London Times or it appeared in the New York Times. You know, like kind of like that New York Times story that appeared on Christmas Eve about how the only from a professor in Texas, as a matter of fact, saying that the only solution to Iran's nuclear ambitions was to bomb it. Now, the problem is these stories create a narrative, and at a certain point, other people rely on this narrative to continue it and to push it to even farther extremes, and that's why they're dangerous.
Right. Well, and that's why the purpose of this show is to try to construct a narrative around actual facts instead of made-up ones, and, you know, with an eye toward preventing war. It doesn't seem like there are any truthful reasons why we need to have a war with Iran. That's why the continuous lies to create the narrative that you refer to here, which is wholly false. I mean, when even the AP and the New York Times, when it really comes down to it, when they have to actually put the fact of the matter in a paragraph somewhere, they will say something like, the Americans are concerned about Iran's nuclear program. In other words, they have nothing. They have nothing at all, Phil, and they admit it.
Yeah, well, that's because they have nothing. I mean, the fact is for all the, you know, and this is not to say Iran's government is behaving responsibly or is behaving in a constructive way. They're not. It's not to be defending Iran and what Iran represents, and particularly in this crackdown they're doing right now.
This week especially.
Reprehensible. But the fact is we're not defending Iran here, but we're just saying that the case for Iran being irresponsible in the area of developing a nuclear weapon has not been made, and that the case for the United States to be behaving belligerently towards Iran and threatening war, that case has not been made either.
Okay, so let's make this case about these documents, this article in the Times here. The headline is, "A Secret Document Exposes Iran's Nuclear Trigger." You say you have friends in the intelligence community or sources in the intelligence community who tell you that they decided that these documents were not credible way back then. But let's talk about some of the reasons why here.
Well, you know, it's a bit hard to describe why something appears right off the bat to be bogus. But if you're an intelligence officer, you produce these documents. So you have kind of a feel for what they look like. And a characteristic of these documents is they're always kind of nonspecific, and the language is always a little bit funny, and because you don't want to get nailed down in facts in the document. And that's why this document was rather peculiar. A couple of people have noted it had, even though it's apparently top secret, it had no security classification on it. It didn't have the kinds of names and office names inside the document itself that would indicate to you that it was authentic. So there were a number of triggers or a number of indicators that this was a phony story. And I gather there have been some things today on the internet in terms of other areas, errors in terms of orthography and typography and everything that seem to be in the document. So there apparently, for somebody who knows what to look for, there are a lot of things in this document that would tip you off.
In fact, you know, I got an email like that. I wonder if this is the same thing you're talking about. It was George Matschke, who identified problems with the typeset, that it was obviously typed in Arabic, as though the Iranian top secret intelligence people don't have access to Farsi software for their typing or something.
Yeah, that's one of the stories that's been going around. So apparently there were a lot of indicators that for people who know what to look for in these kinds of documents that would tell you that it's basically fraudulent.
Mm-hmm. Well, in Gareth Porter's story, again, it's on antiwar.com today. Giraldi says U.S. Intel found Iran nuke document was forged. He points out in here that the security seals aren't there. There are no security seals on these top secret documents. Hey, Phil, Well, I know you weren't an Iranian agent, but an American one. But does that make any sense to you? I mean, even possibly. Like, let's give the benefit of the doubt to the war party here, if we can. Is it possible that you would have top secret Iranian documents that don't have some kind of stamp that says so on them?
I can't imagine that that would be possible. And knowing the way government documents read, which is something I do know, I can't imagine that this document, which obviously is used within the Iranian government and within their nuclear program, allegedly, would not have very specific information on, including names and identities and office designations and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, and here's one too: is I read about this in the Times last week, and I thought, you know, I don't know about, I can't read Arabic. I could not have identified all the flaws that your sources, Gareth Porter, George Mashke, others have identified in here. But I'm friends with a nuclear physicist, and his name's Doc Prather. And I got him on my list here on my cell phone. And I just call up Doc Prather and say, hey, what is this about the uranium deuteride as a nuclear trigger, this, that, the other thing? And again, he just laughed and just talks about how silly these things are. In fact, uranium deuteride would inhibit fission. And you would use that perhaps as part of a process in a uranium reactor for energy purposes or something, but that you would use it for a trigger for a nuclear bomb doesn't make any sense at all. You're trying to hold the explosive metal together as long as possible and get a supercritical mass and a chain reaction out of absolutely as much of the stuff as possible, which means as fast as possible during a nuclear detonation. You wouldn't use this uranium deuteride stuff, whatever it is that they say, which would actually slow that reaction down. So just on its face, there, the accusation makes no sense, which makes me wonder, well, who forged these documents? Don't they have to do at least a somewhat credible job in trying to put these things together? That's a pretty big flaw. If uranium deuteride would inhibit a nuclear reaction, Phil?
Well, I mean, you know, I obviously I don't know who forged the document, but it could be, it could certainly be one of the dissident Iranian groups that are subsidized both by the Pentagon and by the Israeli intelligence service, you know, like MEK and MEK's overt arm. You know,
the NCRI.
The NCRI. These groups tend to come up with these documents and then pass them to the intelligence services, or the intelligence services come up with the documents and pass them to them, who then hold a press conference to you know, say, here's this document that proves that they have a program. And either way, but I mean, it could be the MEK people weren't, they probably went to Wikipedia or something like that to figure out how the process worked and got it wrong.
You know,
so, I mean, anything is possible. This is kind of a world of, you know, where you're faking a document. You try to get it as good as you can possibly get it, but you might not get it right. And that's how these documents very often are exposed.
This is Anti-War Radio on KPFK. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Philip Giraldi. And now, look, this isn't just, you know, an interesting exercise in debunking things that politicians say and lousy reporters regurgitate. I mean, we're talking about the march to war here based on a pile of lies that ultimately on examination are no more credible than what they said about Saddam Hussein, really. I mean, in fact, there is a nuclear program of some description in Iran. I guess that's the qualitative difference, since Saddam Hussein had no nuclear program whatsoever at all. But other than that, this is basically a total lie, a gigantic lie, but based on virtually nothing, as the Congress is passing more sanctions. I don't know, do you know if Obama's planning on implementing these things?
Well, I suspect he's not. I expect he doesn't want another situation in the Middle East. But he's being pushed very hard by Congress and the media. Washington Post certainly has come out very strongly in support of going after Iran with stronger sanctions. So, you know, there's a lot of pressure on him. You know, and the fact is this, basically, okay, maybe Iran does have a secret nuclear program. But the thing is, when you're talking about war and going to war, you have to have credible evidence that that's the case and that there is some malign intent that's driving this process. You know, otherwise you don't go to war. And you talk. Your jaw is better than war, right? And you know, that's what bothers me about this whole thing. And I fully expect in the next few days that we're going to be hearing from Republicans and Joe Lieberman about how Yemen is threatening the United States. In fact, we've already heard it from Lieberman. And we have to take preemptive action against Yemen.
Well, in fact, there were rumors in the press, and we're going to get to Yemen in more detail coming up here, but there were rumors in the press that Iran was backing whatever the trouble is in Yemen, and then the CIA, I think it was, or maybe the State Department, I'm sorry, I don't have this footnote right in front of me, but I saw it just within the last week where the U.S. government, some executive agency, officially said, no, Iran is not behind what's going on in Yemen, but yes, we're bombing Yemen.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the logic that we expect to see from the U.S. government at the moment. Iran, Iran is in the neighborhood of all these other countries, and Iran does get involved and engaged and stir things up. There's no question about that. But the fact is, alleging that they are supporting insurgencies against the Yemeni government is ridiculous, because this fighting has been going on for 30 years. And it's been going on, and there are at least, I believe, five identifiable groups that have been shooting each other. So all of a sudden, dependent on Iran and like Joe Lieberman to suddenly rush in and make a case for preemptive warfare. Oh, my God. I mean, this is just so awful.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing about having no shame and not being bound by the truth, is you get to just go with, whatever sounds right for your agenda on any given day. And I guess if you have the benefit of a media that is just incapable of learning anything and retaining it as knowledge for more than, a day or two, for use as maybe, a follow-up question later or something, then you get to get away with that. And as you said, it's already worked, right? It's already a done deal. The American people, the Pew Charitable Trust, in combination with the Council on Foreign Relations, did a big study, and the American people are worse on Iran than the membership of the Council on Foreign Relations, Phil.
Yeah, well, I'm no surprise there. I mean, it's just, it's incredible. There's been this propaganda machine, and most people see only the propaganda. They never see, for example, the Garrett Porter article citing me about how this report was a fake, so they're not seeing the other side of this at all. So you can't really blame them. I mean, they're ignorant by design.
Yeah. Well, I mean, their willingness to be lied to about something like this, I mean, I could see not being interested enough to look up the truth, but still you could disbelieve them by default from now on instead of going along, especially after Iraq. You would think that people could learn that lesson that, oh, another country that begins with IRA and is a neighbor and a rival of Israel is accused of making nuclear bombs and we have to kill them before they kill us, huh? I've heard that exact one before. And it wasn't true then, come on.
Well, you're right. I mean, you would think that at a certain point, fool me once and fool me twice. And we're about to get fooled a third time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and so let me make sure I've covered what I need to ask you about Iran, what we need to make clear about Iran. Well, I guess if I could ask you to talk about these sanctions a bit here. You say you think Obama doesn't want to enforce these things. What would it mean if Congress got their way and America did what that law says, that if the government carried out what that law says they should there?
Well, basically what it says is that the United States will impose sanctions on Iran, which would prohibit the import of petroleum products. Now, what that means in real terms is that petroleum products, in this context, is refined petroleum products, most of which is coming from elsewhere in the Persian Gulf, from the United Arab Emirates, for example. And this is because Iran, even though it's oil-rich, doesn't have any significant refinery capacity. So it has to import over 40% of its energy, in effect. So if you're shutting off 40% of the country's energy, or that's what you're calling for, you would have to do a number of things. And in fact, the House of Representatives resolution calls for imposing sanctions on any company that in any way participates in the process of getting this energy supply into Iran. That means the ships that carry it. That means the insurance companies that insure the ships. That means the banks that provide the loans to buy the gasoline. That means every step of the process. So that it involves a huge number of companies, both in the Middle East and in Western Europe, that would be sanctionable under this if they provided energy to Iran. And it also means that ultimately, if you were going to enforce the sanctions, in my mind, although the resolution doesn't specifically say this, you would have to use the United States Navy for enforcement. So that's an act of war. And I draw the parallel of what would happen if the United States were to lose 40% of its energy supplies tomorrow, and this was being done by some foreign power, Chinese or Russians, whoever you want to pick. How would we react?
Hydrogen bombs.
Yeah, well, that's it. So, this whole thing is crazy. It's what Justin Raimondo repeatedly refers to as the bizarro world. I mean, you can't even imagine the thinking that goes on in people that passed these resolutions. And I might point out this resolution passed by an overwhelming majority in the House of Representatives. I think it was 412 votes. And so this is insanity at a level that I can't even comprehend it anymore.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, now, you did say that you think Obama's reluctant, that he, at least he's intelligent enough. We can hand him that if he doesn't have, if we don't give him any benefit of the doubt on his motives at all, which I don't, at least he's intelligent enough to see the problem of trying to tackle a war with Iran in the middle of all the other mess that he's got us into. And to that end, he has sort of, kind of attempted to achieve some sort of deal where the Iranians would export their very low enriched uranium to Russia to be enriched to a higher grade, and then to France to be made into fuel rods, and then back to Iran where they can use those fuel rods in their American-built reactor where they can turn this stuff out for medical purposes. And yet the poison pill in the deal, I guess, as Scott Ritter said, it's a poison pill in there. It says that you have to give us your uranium first, and then we'll enrich it higher for you and send it back. And they're saying, well, why don't you give us some 20% and we'll give you some of our 4% at the same time in an even swap, and let's all meet in Turkey and do the swap there. And for some reason, this is absolutely unacceptable to the Americans. Is that basically where we're at in these negotiations here?
As near as I can figure out what's going on, yeah, I think that's the latest wrinkle on the argument that we don't want, even under any circumstances, to give them slightly enriched uranium. For weapons grade, you have to get almost up to 100%. So we're talking about stuff that's far from weapons grade. But of course, the argument, which was made in the New York Times last week by that professor from Texas, was that, oh, well, all this is fungible, and so if you give them some, they're going to take it and they're going to increase it anyway. They're going to work on it and increase its strength anyway. So, the problem is, you can throw out an argument for anything and you can make it sound plausible, but the question becomes what is really going to happen, or why, what would be the motivation for doing X, Y, or Z? And that we're not getting to the core of that, because the Iranians, they are legitimately part of the anti-proliferation treaty. They basically have had inspections at their facilities. They're in line with what other countries do. The problem is that they're Iran, and because right. They're Iran, the rules are all different. So I think basically. Yeah, you can hold your nose while you're doing things and while you're negotiating, but you have to negotiate in good faith, and you have to deal with the other person as if he is someone that is also negotiating in good faith. And until you're proven wrong on that, you continue to do it.
Yeah, well, and here's the thing, too, is it's pretty obvious that there's, I don't know if you want to call it good faith or exactly, what the term for it is, but it seems pretty clear that the Iranians are saying, look, we could configure our centrifuges and turn out uranium at 20-something percent, U-235, a high enough grade to use in our medical reactor facility, but again, not nearly weapons grade. But You know what? We don't even want to reconfigure our centrifuges. Right now, we're turning it out at 3.7%, right around there. And we know that if we change our centrifuges, our cascades around, and configure them to produce at even 20%, which is technically highly enriched uranium, you'll nuke us off the face of the earth. Our hands are up. Don't shoot. Okay? Look, we need uranium for our medical reactor. So here, we'll give you our 3.6%. You give us some 20, and that way we don't even have to enrich to above 4% and make you panic. I mean, is that just me, or I mean, that seems to be written all over these news stories here.
Well, and there have also been news stories indicating, and sources also from intelligence services, saying that Iran has technical problems in its enrichment processes. So they might be recognizing that they're having they don't have a real good capability to get by the technical hurdles to enrich beyond a certain point. And this is something we're kind of forgetting about in terms of this march to war.
That's why they're not trying. They're afraid they'll fail in front of everybody.
Sure. And it's like, you know, it's like with their ballistic missile program, which is the other big threat that is constantly cited. You know, there's a lot of good intelligence reporting out there indicating that Iran's ballistic missile program has largely been a failure, that a lot of the alleged launches of missiles and stuff like that have failed to hit targets, have failed to perform correctly. And, you know, but nobody's talking about that narrative. They're talking about the other one, that Iran is going to have ballistic missiles ready to deliver nuclear warheads to the entire Middle East and Europe. So it's, you know, this kind of thing, that this is why it's so dangerous that these stories get out all the time, saying things about Iran that are extremely derogatory, because it creates its own kind of inertia. And as you note, it certainly has convinced a large percentage of the U.S. population that Iran is some kind of threat.
This is Anti-War Radio on KPFK in Los Angeles. We'll take a short break and be right back. You're listening to Anti-War Radio on KPFK. All right, folks, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio on KPFK, 90.7 FM in L.A., 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Philip Giraldi. He's a former CIA agent. He's a contributing editor at the American Conservative magazine and also writes for antiwar.com and the Campaign for Liberty website. Well, you know, I actually Googled my own congresswoman here in my neighborhood in Los Angeles. I'm sorry, I forget her name. She seemed pretty good on a lot of stuff, but boy, the number one danger in the whole world is Iran. And she just doesn't know anything about it. She's a liberal Democrat, a black woman. She's the kind of lady who, you know, by default would probably not be an Iraq war supporter, for example, that kind of thing. I don't know that much about her. But boy, does she believe the hype about Iran. And apparently it's not in question what a horrible threat they are. And you can tell because everybody agrees. And so that's the measure
right.
of it.
And right. That's the danger. That's the danger with these narratives developing that have their own life. And if it's based on 90% stuff that's either speculative or false, that doesn't make any difference because it's the narrative that's convincing.
Right. And then what's the anti-war person supposed to argue when they've conceded all of the so-called facts to the war party? Well, it's true that everybody knows Iran is the greatest terrorist threat on the face of the earth. And everybody knows Iran has threatened to obliterate Israel in the blink of an eye. And everybody knows Iran is making nuclear weapons. What's anyone, any anti-war person, supposed to say once they've conceded all of those bogus facts? Well, give the inspectors more time, or make sure that Russia and France agree on the Security Council, and then it's okay to bomb them? When actually none of those facts are right. None of us should have to concede any of these things to a bunch of hysterical warmongers, the very same ones who got Iraq so wrong.
That's right. And you know, and it's very important to at the same time point out, look, that we're not apologists for Iran. I mean, that's not what this is all about. We're apologists for the United States. I mean, we want the United States not to get into another war. And if there are there are good reasons and good issues that could be negotiated that would keep us from getting in another war, then that's exactly the road we should be going down.
Yeah, absolutely. Imagine that, peace as the goal. Like Ivan Elin's book, Recarving Mount Rushmore, you know, where he tells you that actually all the greatest presidents were guys you never heard of because they never really killed anybody.
That's right.
You know? All right. Well, here's the deal. It's Anti-War Radio. My guest is Philip Giraldi. And Phil, you're a former CIA guy, but for some reason I trust you anyway, and it's mostly because I guess we've been talking for years now on the show, and you always seem like a straight shooter. You do things like debunk the case for war with Iran on a daily basis. Basically. And so now I want to ask you about the war on terrorism, and particularly as it pertains to Yemen. Barack Obama is now officially, I guess, going to escalate this war on the Arabian Peninsula. Is this going to be, do you think, a joint special operations command, CIA drone strike, covert forces kind of deal? Or are we talking about maybe some kind of Marine beachhead in Yemen?
Well, I don't think we're talking about a Marine beachhead, but I think we're talking about what you said initially, that it would be a special operations and CIA and lots of weapons and training and that sort of thing being suddenly appearing in Yemen. I think it's going to be that kind of warfare, and I think it's going to be another big bust. It's going to be precisely like all these other wars that we've engaged in recently, where we don't know what we're getting into. It's an extremely complicated situation inside Yemen politically. You could claim plausibly that there's been a civil war going on there, for the past 50 years, and that there are all kinds of tribal groupings, and there are personal groupings, there are religious issues, there are a whole lots of different things that play into this. We're going in there. We don't know anything. We won't have people that even speak the language, as usual, and it'll be ignorance is bliss. One mistake after another. We'll be propping up the government because that's the easiest thing to do, and they probably have a few guys running around that speak English. And it's going to be another catastrophe where we're going to have people targeting us, terrorists targeting us, because we're there, because we're doing things. And, it just makes no sense whatsoever, because one guy now has developed an underwear bomb, gotten onto an airplane, and he was in Yemen. We're going to turn this into a cause for war, which is, again, totally bogus. Totally bogus.
Right. Well, Yemen, and the fun part is it's already working even on us. I mean, I know you know better, but still the way that it comes out of your mouth, or at least in that last sentence, right, was we got our cause and effect all backwards here. America's been bombing Yemen at least the past few weeks with the help of the Saudis. It's been all over the papers. And if we believe the official claim of responsibility for this thing, they're saying, yeah, we did this as a revenge for you bombing us. We found a guy we could put on a plane to America, and we did so.
That's right, yeah. And in fact, of course, the bombing of Yemen goes back way before the last few weeks. It was we've had drone strikes and everything in Yemen over the past 4 or 5 years.
Oh, right, in connection with the Lackawanna 6 and all
right,
that.
Right, there have been a number of attacks. And most of which we did not accredit them to us, but now, of course, we are. And it's always the same story. Don't we ever get it that if you're messing around in these other places and you're killing people in these other places, there are people that are going to try to get even. I don't know, Scott. It's hopeless the way these things play out, at least in my mind.
Well, you think the people that run the CIA Counterterrorism Center are as stupid as the people who cover these issues on TV? Because, you know, I saw Ron Paul say to Larry King last night, look, man, we bomb them, then they bomb us back. History didn't begin on September 11th. It didn't begin on Christmas Eve. It began way back in the day, and America's been bombing the Middle East in general, supporting their dictators, et cetera, et cetera. We started it, and now we have trouble. They're terrorists because we occupy them, he said. And Larry King and Ben Stein and Sheila Jackson Lee looked at Ron Paul like they couldn't even understand what he was saying. They were like, oh, what do you mean America started it? That, huh?
Well, Ben Stein called Ron Paul an anti-Semite.
Right, even though he didn't mention that, you know, Osama bin Laden and Mohammed Atta both said that the reason they did it is American support for Israel.
Yeah, yeah.
He didn't even mention that part of it at all. He didn't say anything about Israel at all.
Well, this is the whole point. I mean, if you control the narrative, you control the narrative in such a way as to make it say what you want. And Ron Paul is saying, no, this is not what the narrative is. There's a much bigger narrative out there, a much bigger story. And, of course, he's absolutely right. And, you know, it's at this point, it's a maybe it's an education process where somebody like Ron Paul has to achieve enough prominence where he can actually tell people that, look, this is what's going on, and people will be in a position to listen. But, you know, it hasn't happened yet.
Well, it really is amazing because as we're talking here, it's what, the 29th today? 28th or 29th?
29th.
We're here. We're wrapping up the first decade of the 21st century now. And we're right where we were at in this time, 2001, where people are going, you know, as far as I can tell, they hate us because we're angels and they're devils. And there's no difference between Osama bin Laden, the Ayatollah Khamenei, the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, and the Hezbollah, and for that matter, guerrillas in the Philippines and in some valley in Georgia, former Soviet Georgia, not the one north of Florida.
Yeah,
there,
yeah.
You know, basically where the American people's brain is just empty and wide open to be filled with nonsense. We've done no better in all this time.
Well, actually, we've done a lot worse, Scott. We have about 5,400 dead Americans. We have some hundreds of thousands of dead Iraqis and Afghans. We have a huge national debt that is dragging the country down. And we have Patriot Acts and Military Commissions Acts and going to war without an act of Congress. We're actually a lot worse off than we were in 2001.
Man, all right. Well, so how much better or worse off is Al-Qaeda? Because, you know, I read a story one time by Robert Dreyfus in Rolling Stone a few years back. I think it was called The Bogus War on Terrorism, or something very close to that. And he had quotes from CIA guys who apparently were there who said, look, we pointed our laser designators at Osama bin Laden and his buddies, and the Air Force dropped massive explosives on their heads. And, you know, maybe if few dozen of them escaped, and that's all Al-Qaeda was at that point. You know, and basically, you wrote this article telling me what I don't want to hear, which is there actually really is such a thing as Al-Qaeda now, Al-Qaeda the movement, and that it is in North Africa and probably in places like Yemen, and there are people already, you know, I don't know, you tell me what number you think, there's a certain number of people already on this planet who must have decided, if not before 9/11, certainly since, that what they would like to do is kill Americans, and if they have to die doing so, then that's what the hell they'll do. Not probably too much unlike this guy that tried to kill these people on Christmas Day.
Well, there, you know, it's. I don't know if our intelligence community actually has any good idea of how many Al Qaeda terrorists there are. But Al Qaeda, you know, it's a franchise. It's a label. The people in Yemen use it. The people in the Maghreb in North Africa use it. There are people in Iraq who use it. There are people in Western Europe who use it. And then, of course, there is Al Qaeda, whatever it is, in Pakistan. And the fact is, it's a franchise. It's not, as far as anybody can tell, centrally controlled anymore. But yeah, I mean, the reason why the all these groups call themselves Al Qaeda because it gives them a cachet. It gives them a certain level of significance and self esteem. And a lot of these people are willing to kill themselves or die themselves to strike against the United States because we are over there. And because we are involved in all these different places. And there's no question, but that's what drives this process, as Ron Paul has pointed out and many others have pointed out. And, you know, it's just, again, this is absolutely mindless on the part of policymakers in the United States not to recognize that there is a quid pro quo that comes out of, you know, what was the Newtonian rule, that for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction. This is also true in politics. And it's also true in terrorism. So, you know, we can't seem to get it right. And I had a lot of hope. I had a lot of optimism for Obama coming in. But to be quite honest, he's in many ways, I think he's worse than Bush.
Yeah, I'm afraid I have to agree with that. It's really the only way that he's better than Bush actually amounts to him being worse. What was good about Bush was that he was a clown. And so the degree to which that diminished his power as the ultimate dictator of the planet Earth, we benefited. Whereas Obama's a little more competent in his exact same role.
Right. He's changed the tone of the conversation. People are willing to listen to him, whereas they were not willing to listen to Bush. But he's pushing basically the same snake oil. There's no question about it. And I'm sure he would be quite happy to be able to disengage from Afghanistan in some way. But if he's interested in doing that, he's going about it the wrong way.
Mm-hmm. Hey, by the way, do you think that or what do you make of all this official story about this guy, the Nigerian attempted Christmas bomber there who set himself on fire trying to blow up that plane, apparently. Napolitano, the head of the SA or whatever you call it, says that there's no evidence that he's linked to any larger plot, but then the whole other theme is that, oh yeah, he's tied to these Guantanamo guys. And then there are at least two credible reports, one from mlive.com, which is Michigan news there, and also at the Huffington Post, an article by a guy named Roey Rosenblith. And he says that he also, he saw part of the same thing this other guy reported, which was the arrest of a well-dressed Indian man. And apparently there were two different well-dressed Indian men, one of whom helped this guy get on the plane in the first place. And yet, best I can tell, I think NPR, maybe a couple others covered it, but this doesn't seem to really be working its way into the official narrative of what happened with this attempted attack here. Phil, what's going on, do you think?
Well, I don't know what's going on. I have seen those reports you're talking about. There are other reports that he bought the ticket with cash, which should have been a red flag immediately. There were reports that he was assisted by an Indian through immigration and in Amsterdam. There were reports that he had contacts with other people. There have been a number of reports, and until we have some kind of authoritative investigation that tells us what happened, we won't know what the story is. Napolitano, I'm afraid, by her comments and everything, indicated she's totally unqualified for the position she holds, although I don't know really much about that position, as I would abolish the Department of Homeland Security tomorrow if I were president. But the fact is that she as a governor of Arizona, she doesn't really know anything about what she's talking about.
Yeah, well, her qualifications is she's run, I guess, on the platform before of keeping Mexicans out, but in a way that's not too offensive to Democrats or something. I don't know.
Right, exactly.
Something like that.
Yeah, she's a Democrat who allegedly was strong on border security, so that clearly qualified her to head the Department of Homeland Security, at least in the mind of the president.
But yeah, she said this guy almost blowing up the plane and a passenger jumping up and beat the guy's ass and putting the fire out. Yeah. That's the system worked, she said.
Right, she said that, and then she recanted. But the fact is that, sure, this guy had help from somebody, whether it was al-Qaeda or somebody calling themselves al-Qaeda in Yemen, whether it was Indians. But, of course, Indian is a generic for any South Asian. That could be a Pakistani, it could be a Bangladeshi, it could be an Indian, it could be a Sri Lankan, it could be almost anything.
Yeah, I tried to get a hold of the lawyer who wrote that thing at MLive, yeah. The comment there that then they reported on. I couldn't get an interview with him, not yet anyway, but that was my first question, was how do you know they were Indian?
Right, exactly. I mean, it could have been certainly could have been a Pakistani, and Pakistanis... I can spin a couple of possible narratives as why Pakistanis might be involved in this.
Well, what about the CIA just hiring some cutouts to hire a guy to attempt to blow up a bomb? Maybe they made it deliberately mixed it with a bunch of baking powder or something so it wouldn't work too well, and then they get to justify a war in Yemen.
Yeah, keep the war on terror going forever. Well, I mean, anything is plausible. I mean, it's just until we get some serious investigation, and I'm sure the FBI is doing serious investigation of this, and somebody writes a report which is released to the public in detail, we won't know exactly what happened and what the connections were. But there were a lot of things here that are very screwy. I mean, it's Napolitano saying the system worked. Well, the system worked in that there were certain things that the system should have picked up on to stop this guy, But as usual, there was no communication across lines in the U.S. government that enabled that to happen. So the system works in that the information that was there was, or should have been there, was there, but nobody seemed to notice it. So, you know, again, Napolitano was I think, out of her depth when she was commenting on this.
This is Anti-War Radio on KPFK in Los Angeles. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Philip Giraldi from antiwar.com. It's kind of amazing. I guess the guy at the Huffington Post, a part of his article is about how it sort of took a while to get it. That like, oh, wow. Man, that guy was really trying to blow us all up. Holy crap. And, you know, the reality of that is it's sort of like when Ramzi Youssef bombed the World Trade Center after the FBI pulled their informant who was going to make a fake bomb. The FBI pulled their informant, so Ramzi Youssef came in and made a real bomb. And his plan was to knock over one tower into the other. And, you know, in the pretty late in the morning or something, and which could have killed, you know, tens of thousands of people, would have been September 11th times a whole bunch. And luckily, only six people died. He failed to destroy the building and make it fall over in the way that he wanted to. It's kind of like this one. Like, you know, everybody said on Christmas, oh, yeah, did you hear some guy tried to blow up the plane? But the emphasis was on tried. Nobody really panicked, I guess, except the TV people, because it worked out. Nobody died. Passengers on the plane put the guy in check quickly, and that was the end of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the question has to be now, you know, what actually happened? How did this develop? And why was it that the red flags that went up on this guy were not heeded? Because, you know, the last thing we want on Earth is the Joe Lieberman solution, which is to declare war on yet another country and to make airport travel so ridiculously bad that nobody will travel. And the fact is that, you know, you don't want to institute another bunch of draconian rules about how you travel and everything like that. There are probably some simple fixes in what the existing system is that could have stopped this guy, but they weren't heeded. And I think that's the problem here. And but of course, everybody's going to go crazy. They're going to have new rules about, you know, how you have to sit in your seat. You can't put your hands in your lap. You know, you might as well put everybody in a straitjacket on the airplane and put them on board.
Well, I guess let me ask you this, man. I mean, if you really want to end all these occupations, you want to end this sort of, you know, brutal violence, killing women and children like we're doing in Yemen and creating more problems like this, what do you do with, you know, the few thousand that are out there? If you could really have a Ron Paul foreign policy where all the troops came home, where we really were able to say, look, we're done with all that intervention. Sorry about all of that. You know, what about the hardcore who still want to kill us? I mean, are we still going to have a police state to protect us from them?
Well, I believe if we withdrew from all these places, we wouldn't need a police state to protect us, because I think most of the people who are motivated today to come after us would no longer be motivated. There would be hardcore terrorists. There still would be terrorists who have agendas that are so refined that you can't really deal with them in any way. And yeah, sure, you need to continue to have an intelligence service. You need to continue to have a police resources, law enforcement resources. You need to have military resources in a limited way against terrorism. But what you really have to understand is that you have to change the way we interact with with the world. And once you change the way we interact, and this is what Ron Paul is saying, then a lot of these threats will go away.
Well, I mean, there's a certain amount of enemies, the incorrigible ones, that have been created already. But I guess you're right that, well, and, you know, Robert Pape says in his book where he studied these things, like the suicide bombings by Hezbollah, they stopped immediately after Israel withdrew from southern Lebanon. And they could, and in fact, the way he says it, it was, you know, you could completely consider the motives and tactics and strategies of the leaders of Hezbollah out. And the fact of the matter is, nobody was willing to be a suicide bomber when there wasn't an occupying army to fight. The occupying army was over on the other side of the line again, and I'm sure there's, as we all know, there's no love lost between Hezbollah and the IDF on opposite sides of the line, but the Hezbollah guys aren't willing to blow themselves up when they're not actually occupied. So it seems like that's a pretty good precedent to go with there, you know?
Yeah, there are a number of precedents where when the occupation ceases, then the terrorism ceases. And in fact, Israel itself was more subject to terrorist attacks when it was in full occupation of the West Bank. And, you know, when they withdrew from certain areas, that diminished the anger against them to a certain extent and reduced the number of terrorist incidents against them. And, of course, there is the example of Hezbollah, too, which also involved Israel. So, yeah, occupation is what drives this. Interference, support of governments that are oppressive in the Muslim world drives it. There are a lot of things that drive it. But you know, it's our own actions, basically, that create this problem.
You wrote an article a couple of weeks back saying, you know, there comes a point when you just can't really believe this whole story that Osama's holed up in Pakistan anymore. He must be dead by now.
Yeah, there are a lot of academics and intelligence people and government officials who've looked at the evidence who believe that there is no evidence that Osama bin Laden is alive, that the last verifiable and confirmable time when anybody saw him in the flesh close enough to confirm that it was him was back in December 2001.
Well, what about the speech of October 04? Was that a CIA scam, you think?
No, I've spoken to people who are technical experts. They say that bin Laden has a huge library or repertoire of speeches that he's given through the years. And people that are skilled enough at putting all these things together can construct speeches, can produce a credible Osama bin Laden video or audio tape. These things can be put together, particularly if you deliberately are setting out to be deceptive. You take the tape and you degrade the quality and you run it through a few times, and you can do a number of things to make it very plausible, very credible, but nevertheless something that, you know, you can't say 100% that's what it is.
But you wouldn't think that it's our side doing that. You think what, Zawahiri's doing it, or they're faking him too?
I would think you have to look at who benefits from it. And yeah, right.
Well, lots of different people benefit from it.
Sure.
I mean, hell, you
sure,
and I benefit from it if it comes to like having something to write or talk about on the radio, you know?
Yeah, well, no, that's right. I mean, the CIA definitely would have and the U.S. government would have a motive in keeping him alive, in a manner of speaking.
I always kind of imagined it would be like that, or since around the time 8 years ago, that it would be like that movie, The Siege, with Denzel Washington
right.
and Bruce Willis, where, in fact, I guess it's Iraqis in that, Shiite Iraqis. But anyway, the point is that their leader, the movie begins with Bruce Willis abducts the Osama bin Laden of that movie, but keeps it secret from everyone that they've even got him.
That's right, yeah. So, you know, there certainly would be people motivated to keep him, or the fiction of his continued existence, alive. And, of course, Al-Qaeda, in terms of to the extent that it still exists, obviously would want to keep him alive as a figurehead. So there are people with motives for keeping a dead terrorist leader alive, at least as a cyber personality.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, I guess I always figured, without, you know, because I knew I didn't know, but I guess, you know, my guess was that if he died, rather, you know, in any way other than the Americans getting him, that Zawahiri and everybody else would say, ha ha, see, our great, our friend, our leader, whatever, he died and you never got your grubby paws on him. How do you like that? Well, you know, wouldn't they or something? I thought, I don't know. Maybe did and it was buried and I didn't see it.
Well, that would be one possibility, but as I say, there are other possibilities to want to keep him alive, and in terms of, you know, the fact that he has survived the American onslaught and everything. So there are different ways to twist it. It depends on what your actual agenda is and what your game plan is. But sure, there would be a number of parties that would want to keep him going.
Hmm. Yeah, well, good stuff. I think you're probably right too. I mean, and it's funny how it did sort of turn into like, wait a minute, how long have I believed this in a row? This just doesn't feel right anymore, kind of. We never, this whole time, I mean, even today when they say that there's Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Pakistan, they really never prove that. They never show us one dead Arab, ever. They just say that it's true. And so then it's only a question of whether we guess it seems right or not. That's all it's ever been.
That's right. Yeah,
it's like the power of nightmares, where they never found any Al-Qaeda at all or something.
That's right. Even the generals in Afghanistan have conceded that there are very few Al-Qaeda, if any, in Afghanistan. And as to how many there are in Pakistan, who knows?
All right, everybody, that's Phil Giraldi. He is a contributing editor at the American Conservative Magazine and, of course, writes for us at antiwar.com for the Campaign for Liberty and the American Conservative Defense Alliance. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Scott.
And thanks, everybody, for listening. Happy New Year, and here's to a little less war in 2010. Anti-War Radio is produced for KPFK by Angela Keaton and Louis Vandenberg, engineered by Alan Minsky. I'm your host and executive producer, Scott Horton.